This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Today is the fourth and final episode of our mini-series focusing on healthcare in a pandemic. And to join me on this episode is public policy specialist, Dr. Kaw Swee King. And today we're looking at whether ASEAN needs its own CDC. So one of the things that the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us is how we can all come together to help each other when the going gets tough. But we've seen that mostly at the community level. But at the global level, yes, we have seen some countries lending others a helping hand by providing resources such as the expertise of doctors or even supplies of PPEs, things like that. But is this enough to ensure global health security to tackle the current pandemic and others to come? So we would like to unpack some of these questions today. How are you today, Swee King?
Very well, Xiaoyik, and it's a pleasure to be back.
Yes. Let's start small, if you can call it, by looking at ASEAN. Just a refresher for those of you who need a bit of that sejarah lesson back in your minds. It's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. So ASEAN is an intergovernmental organization made up of 10 states from the region. And, the issue of ASEAN, cooperation and all of that comes up when we are discussing economic, social and political cooperation. But when it comes to health, what are the mechanisms that we have within the ASEAN framework?
Well, we'll begin by understanding the structure of the ASEAN Secretariat itself, which is based in Jakarta. And ASEAN has a stated objective of three stated objectives. The first one is political, the second one is economic, the third one is socio-cultural. And in the political element, obviously, security is an important component. Health intersects with the three major aims of ASEAN in the security element and in the socio-cultural element. There are 46 divisions in ASEAN. And health is one of 46 divisions. Mm. This is a small indication to us about the relative priority that health has in ASEAN, and the relative priority is low. The ASEAN Secretariat's health division also has about 5 to 10 people, I would say only 5 to 10 people, and therefore indicating to you the amount of available human resources, financial capital and political capital available to us. There is at least a health division. Secondly, in ASEAN, currently available framework, are nation states taking the lead in various capacities? For example, in Thailand, they host the Food Safety Network in ASEAN. Mm. Or Indonesia, that hosts the Humanitarian Assistance for Disaster Management, the Center for Humanitarian Assistance during Disasters. And these are delegated to the nation states for them to lead. Needless to say, there will be some regional, shall we say, rivalries or competition. And there isn't enough cohesion within ASEAN, and that's within the existing landscape.
Why is health cooperation important within this regional framework?
For a couple of reasons. Two main reasons, Xiaoyik. The first one is ASEAN itself is a remarkably integrated region. Without going into the numbers, we have lots of trade, lots of tourism, lots of social ties and familial ties within ASEAN as well. That's on one level. So if we take care of Southeast Asia, we're also assuring not only the security of other people, but we're also assuring the security of ourselves. So that's one big reason why we should be taking care of ASEAN health. Mm-hmm. The second reason why we should take care of ASEAN health is in the sense that in this specific region, with so much human mobility, not just in terms of economic, right, but in terms of human migration, and both regular and irregular, and also the refugee population, it becomes important for us to preserve the health security of ASEAN by taking care of our neighbours. We're only as strong as our weakest link, and therefore, these are two very compelling reasons for us to care for ASEAN health.
All right. So when we come back to the health, how health sits within the ASEAN framework and what you described earlier, it's one thing that we have that on paper, but how effective is it in terms of, decisions and governmental decisions that are made regarding health issues?
The short answer is that this infrastructure in the existing landscape is not very effective. That's a short answer. But there are several reasons why. Firstly, ASEAN is not set up to talk about health. It's set up to talk about the economy. Mm-hmm. Therefore, when you talk about health, a lot of the conversation is less about disease security or infectious diseases surveillance. It's more about trade-related aspects of health. For example, health tourism, medical travel as one component. component. Mm-hmm. Mutual recognition of health professionals. What that means is a Filipino doctor will be able to practice in Thailand, for example. And thirdly, the regulation of pharmaceutical products, such as drugs and medicines, as well as technologies. These are the trade-related aspects of health, and we do well. But when it comes to other aspects of public health, for example, information sharing, when it comes to the number of COVID cases and the supplies of personal protective equipment, ASEAN countries they have bilateral channels, but they don't have a regular multilateral channel within ASEAN to share the information. Perhaps, unfortunately, it requires their personal friendships and relationships, or more international organizations like the World Health Organization to convene this kind of conversations.
Is that gap a historical sort of artifact of ASEAN?
It is. While Southeast Asia and ASEAN has got 10 member states, the World Health Organization is divided into 6 regions. Mm-hmm. Three ASEAN countries, Indonesia, Myanmar and Thailand, belong to the Southeast Asia Regional Office as based in Delhi. Yep. And the other 7 Southeast Asian countries belong to the Western Pacific Regional Office that's based in Manila. Mm-hmm. So there's 3 in reporting to Delhi and 7 reporting to Manila, means that there are no opportunities within the WHO framework for Southeast Asian countries to talk to each other, because it's been split between these 2 WHO regions. Mm-hmm. And as you might imagine, New Delhi is dominated by the Indian subcontinent, and the Western Pacific region is dominated by China, Japan and Australia, which reduces and dilutes the voice of Southeast Asia as well.
Why do we need WHO to facilitate that kind of cooperation, though, if we have ASEAN?
Well, that's a great question. I wish that the WHO would carve out the Southeast Asia Regional Office and direct it only for Southeast, geographically true Southeast Asia countries. Mm-hmm. But it would be very difficult and perhaps almost impossible for the World Health Organization to restructure the geographic regions. Let me close that door, because it's probably a non-starter. Mm-hmm. Because the WHO is not involved in convening ASEAN health, therefore the ASEAN Secretariat becomes very important. The structural gaps in ASEAN Secretariat are, as what I've mentioned earlier, the setup for political and security and economy and sociocultural, less for health. In the ideal setting, we'll have the ASEAN Secretariat convening, but in the absence of the ASEAN Secretariat, I could think of a couple of other types of conveners. The first one would be nations, for example. It could be America, the United States, it could be the European Union, it could be the UK, it could be China, Japan coming in to act as a neutral convener for ASEAN. The second group of people would be global health organizations like the Global Fund or Gavi or the Gates Foundation. The third group of people would be multinational companies, especially those that are operating within ASEAN, especially if they can form a consortium among themselves.
Mm. So, you talked about how there was some bilateral conversation, say, between countries that are perhaps... we, Malaysia and Singapore, for instance, we needed to talk to each other really about issues like opening up the causeway, opening up our borders and things like that. But would you say that across the board, when it comes to COVID-19, we are lacking that systematic, concerted kind of multilateral cooperation?
This is true. Malaysia and Singapore share very close historical ties. So it's not surprising that Malaysia and Singapore talk to each other at the technocratic and the political leadership level. However, Malaysia also has borders with Indonesia and with the Philippines, at least a sea border. And Sabah recently, lest we forget, Sabah and southern Philippines in December last year had a polio outbreak. Mm-hmm. And communication on a bilateral basis is not ideal, because it's usually reactive. And it's based on a mutually agreed interest. What we really need in Southeast Asia is a way for all of us to have very regular channels of communication. I'm just inventing. The first Tuesday of every month, all the health ministers of ASEAN should talk. Instead, they talk every 2 years. And in that talk of every 2 years, it's 3 days every 2 years and preceded by all the directors general of health meeting for 1 or 2 days every 2 years as well. That is simply not enough, because the political leadership changes, the directors general change. There is not enough institutional memory for ASEAN to operate. Therefore, a very regular meeting, for example, every first Tuesday of the month for 3 hours, we will talk between the health ministers of ASEAN. That would be a good regular and very routine platform for people to share information.
What do you foresee countries learning from each other in these regular communications?
There would be two major sets of learnings. The first set of learning would be very health systems specific. The second one would be, shall we say, outside the health system, like social policies, economic policies that impact the health system. Let's talk about the health system as the first category. For example, what are you doing in terms of your testing strategy for COVID? What are you doing in terms of your quarantine strategy, your border control strategy, your allocation of healthcare resources, deploying of health professionals? These are very technical questions and information that can be shared on a very regular basis inside the health system. But there are many other avenues for information sharing. For example, what are you doing in terms of your migrant policy? What are you doing in terms of the equivalent of the Bantuan Prihatin, for example, in Thailand? That would be interesting to hear. And although that has got very little directly to do with the health system, it does impact because we're talking about the social determinants of health. These are the two groups of sets of information that can be shared during those regular meetings. Maybe just add one more thing, shall we? Is to say that the regular meetings don't only, or in fact can't only, be at the politician level. It must also be at the technocratic level. For example, the directors of infectious diseases control units need to talk on a very regular basis so that they can share information, trends, best practices, and just bounce ideas off each other.
Is this happening in any fashion at all right now?
Based on information available in the public domain and to the best of my knowledge and after speaking with several people in several countries around Southeast Asia, not in a structured enough format. Of course,
ad hoc.
Mm. Yeah, I know this person. He's my friend. We attended the same conference together 5 years ago. I'll pick up the phone and I'll call this person. But very reactive, very ad hoc. And it's not, I would use the word structured enough. Mm. It's not regular, not routine. It's not in the calendar. It's just, I'll pick up the phone and call this person, and therefore we're losing the ability to be very proactive instead of being very reactive.
Are there issues of sovereignty, national security that might hinder truly open communication, even when we're talking about public health issues?
There would be, and I think in... let me give you the bad news and then hopefully move on to the good news. The bad news is COVID is seeing a rise in nationalism. And in very malicious ways, some governments as well as some non-state actors like terrorist organizations or criminal groups, for example, would seek to use or weaponize COVID to weaken a particular country. And that's from a very malicious sort of health security perspective. And there's always going to be regional competition or international between countries, competition for scarce resources.
That's hypothetical. Is that the weaponization?
Yes. Do you refer to the competition for scarce resources?
No, before that, when you talked about non-state actors looking to weaponize COVID-19, is that purely hypothetical?
It is, it's not purely hypothetical. Evidence continues to emerge about the weaponization of COVID, but it can be done in two broad ways. The first way is direct, for example, introducing somebody with COVID into a population and then triggering mass fears and panic. And I think security agencies are thinking about how to deal with these particular threats at the moment. And that's one element. The second element is for non-state actors to weaken the trust in health systems and or vaccines, for example. If you just cast doubt about the importance of vaccines or the effectiveness of vaccines or the safety of vaccines, in the long run, governments will find it very difficult to vaccinate their population, therefore leading to weakened immune systems and more COVID cases and therefore weakening the economy, the military, and so on and so forth.
Okay. Yeah. So then competition for scarce resources.
Of course. And in around April this year, as COVID started hitting North America and Europe, we saw governments, for example, the American government, coming into the airports in Southeast Asian countries. Let me use the word hijacking, commandeering, or otherwise paying large amounts of money to secure shipments of personal protective equipment like face masks and gloves away from the intended recipients. What I mean is Germany and France had already purchased those face masks, and some agents of the United States of America actually went in to purchase them at the airport tarmac. And that competition was seen in April, and it's a matter of public record. It's less seen today in September because factories have all come back online. China is a factory of the world. Production is all ramped up. So we don't really see a supply issue right now. But this competition will always be a feature of international geopolitics. COVID has only sharpened it and given it a new angle.
All right. The good news.
The good news is in terms of what we can do in terms of regional collaboration. It's important for us as in Malaysia to think that we in Malaysia are only as strong as our weakest link. Meaning if we help our neighbours, not only are we assuring our own public health security, we're also assuring our, secondly, economic security. Thirdly, allowing ourselves in Malaysia to open up a regional travel zone in ASEAN, and which allows us to have better psychological health, better economic health and so on. And fourthly, for countries, for example, like South Korea and Vietnam that donated test kits and face masks, they're actually scoring points and they're increasing their soft power in the world by engaging in what some people are calling health diplomacy. These are the good news and the reasons why Malaysia should be more mindful about regional health in a policy of prospering, not impoverishing our neighbours.
All right. Let's go for a quick break now. But coming up, you have made the case for Southeast Asian countries or this region to have its own centres for disease control and prevention. So almost like an ASEAN CDC. So we will take a look at that concept, how it would work. I'm speaking to public policy specialist Dr. Kaw Swee King today in the fourth and final episode of our mini-series on healthcare in a pandemic. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, public policy specialist Dr. Kaw Swee King for our mini-series on healthcare in a pandemic. And this is our fourth and final episode. We are looking beyond our own borders today. We're looking at the Southeast Asian region, how ASEAN cooperation can play a role when it comes to a health crisis like COVID-19, but also beyond that, how it plays a role in global public health issues. Before the break, you mentioned the term, Swee King, of health diplomacy. Can we just quickly touch on what that means before we go into the idea of ASEAN having its own CDC? But first, health diplomacy.
We'll have to unpack firstly the term diplomacy, and it's a tool of foreign policy for any government in the world. And you can use diplomacy, for example, by force, military diplomacy or gunboat diplomacy. You can use diplomacy to achieve your foreign policy objectives by dangling aid, for example, foreign aid or loans, for example, by the ASEAN Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Chinese Silk Road, for example. This is called checkbook diplomacy. What South Korea did recently has been called test kit diplomacy, more specifically, or health diplomacy more broadly. The South Korean success story of very rapidly supplying test kits in March and April this year to the whole world, in fact. At one time, I think there was about 100 countries lining up to buy test kits from South Korea because their own domestic production could not keep up or could not even begin to manufacture these test kits, meant that South Korea not only gained, shall we say, hard currency, leaving aside the price of it, but they also gained, say, soft power because this is a testament to their ability of their science, manufacturing, public health and regulatory agencies to combine forces and build a lot of safe and effective and very accurate test kits in a very short period of time. It's a testament to the, say, prowess of the South Korean economy. And that's an example of health diplomacy.
Okay. And now coming to, this article that you wrote together with Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmood and two other of your peers from Singapore. And you spoke about the need for Southeast Asia to have its own Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, like what the US has. Why do you think an ASEAN CDC is necessary?
For a few reasons, Shawika. The first reason why an ASEAN CDC is necessary is because we don't have one and we need one. Then the subsidiary question is, why does ASEAN need one? Because Malaysia has got our own Crisis Preparedness and Response Center in CPRC. Singapore has got their own Infectious Diseases Surveillance Unit within the Ministry of Health. The reason is because, firstly, there's intra-ASEAN trade. Secondly, intra-ASEAN movement. And thirdly, this the long and porous maritime borders of Southeast Asia means that we'll be needing a way for us to exchange information because there's so much movement, regular and irregular, between all the countries in Southeast Asia. These are the main, shall we say, the human movement reasons and the economic reasons why we need an ASEAN CDC. The second reason why we need an ASEAN CDC is to mirror some of the regional CDCs that are available around the world. And I point to two examples over here. The first example is the European CDC. And it does a function similar to the United States' CDC by accumulating information from disease surveillance from these member states and then sending out all the signals and operating as a sentinel center so that we can pick up an outbreak sort of as early as possible after it begins. Mm-hmm. The second example is that there is quite a nascent CDC in the Caribbean. And the Caribbean organization, public health organizations and the authorities, granting because they are generally small island nations, have banded together for resource purposes to pull together their funding, their human resources and expertise to have something that can protect the entire region. And that's another reason for Southeast Asia to have our own CDC as well.
Mm. You know, one of the things that has been said about ASEAN is that it's bogged down in bureaucracy. So will something like an ASEAN CDC suffer the same fate?
There is a risk that any organization will be bogged down by bureaucracy. And I think the ASEAN CDC will also have that problem. So I'll have two sets of comments over here. The first one is ASEAN is important to underwrite, to provide the political mandate and also to provide the convening power for the CDC to get started. It is very difficult, nearly impossible to have an ASEAN or Southeast Asian CDC without the ASEAN Secretariat. It is still the best tool, the least imperfect tool and vehicle for us to get an ASEAN CDC. Therefore, ASEAN's role is crucial, imperative, and perhaps necessary for an ASEAN CDC to happen. That's my first set of thoughts. My second set of thoughts, Shawik, is how do we get this started to make sure that it's not laden by bureaucracy? Perhaps by having one country take the leadership in setting up the ASEAN CDC and putting a lot of money and resources into it and then convening the technical experts first. What I mean to say is, we get the political mandate from the ASEAN Secretariat and the ASEAN functions within Jakarta, but very quickly delegate that authority out to one particular nation state in Southeast Asia, invest it with financial capital, and link the universities, link the ministries of health together in an apparatus that is linked to ASEAN, but sufficiently removed from ASEAN that it can move fast enough.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, what does it look like? What kind of functions would the CDC play?
It will not be perfect on day one. Even in the year one, it will not be perfect. So I envision, say, three steps to get to the steady state. And in that steady state, it'll take us 5, maybe even 10 years. Perhaps, unfortunately so, in time for the next pandemic, because this will not be our last pandemic. Mm-hmm. In step one, just plain information exchange. Just share information. What's your bed capacity? How many doctors do you have? What's the number of cases that you have? What's your testing strategy? Just share information through very routine, very regular channels. This will build trust. This will build familiarity with each other. It will build personal relationships that you can then rely on during a crisis. Then the question begs itself, what's in it for countries to share the information? And this is a difficult question to answer. Therefore, the what's in it for countries needs to be carefully and effectively communicated with them. This is not a national security issue. I mean, it is. And to ensure your national security, you actually have to share some of this information. Much of this is already in the public domain. Mm-hmm. And you're sharing this with the World Health Organization. Now you just need to share it with yourself more bilaterally, more multilaterally. Sorry, that's step one, just information sharing. Number two, joint programming, where you have combined programs of surveillance or you build more infrastructure for you to do disease education and things like that. So the joint programming is the second step that will also build more trust and familiarity and systems and networks and relationships. And in the third step, the shall we say the steady state, a bit of capacity sharing. For example, a pre-placed vaccine stockpile or pre-placed masks and personal protective equipment stockpile located in 6 capital cities around Southeast Asia for quick activation that we can then deploy during periods of a humanitarian crisis or pandemic emergencies and things like that. So those are the three steps. Firstly, share information. Number two, do joint programs. And number three, share capacity, for example, personal protective equipment or even human resources like doctors and nurses. Mm.
How do you account for countries that have varying, lower levels of infrastructure and resources and things like that?
We will account for this in two ways. The first way is to have a minimum threshold to encourage countries to spend. The North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, or NATO, has got a 2% of GDP requirement for military spending, meaning all countries in NATO have to spend 2% of their GDP on their military, minimum. Why not, but I think health should have something like that. In ASEAN, we agree that we will spend a minimum, I'm just inventing a number, 6% of GDP on health. And that minimum, say, standards setting would be one step to raise the denominator, and it's a rising tide that lifts all boats. That's one important component. The second important component is for the richer, better resourced, or more structured countries to help the ones that are, say, trying to get there. And actually, shall we, will be surprised. Vietnam, for example, since the SARS epidemic in 2003, Vietnam spent year on year 9% more than the previous year. The statistic
more
is...
More than the previous year.
So it was a year-on-year-on-year increase, 9% in the last 17 years. And this is one big reason why Vietnam is doing so well in COVID, almost no community transmission for about 4 to 6 months until they had small clusters recently. So we'll be actually surprised about which countries can teach other countries in Southeast Asia.
That's true. In light of that, we're talking about huge sums of money, lots of resources that will be pooled and shared out. Who provides oversight?
A great question. Off the top of my head, there will be two groups of people that will have to provide oversight. The first group of people will be national governments, because they're committing their public funds and their taxpayer funds into it. And within each national government, it's important for their usual mechanisms like the Auditor General, civil society, and the Universal Periodic Review, which is a framework of the United Nations March Towards the Sustainable Development Goals. Mm-hmm. These are the existing frameworks that we can hold people accountable and the funding accountable within nation states. This is number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, any creation of an ASEAN CDC, and my apologies for not mentioning this earlier, requires a convener in the first instance. On the 9th of September this year, the US State Department, United States' State Department, announced that the United States CDC will assist in the creation of an ASEAN CDC. I'm not saying the United States should come in and help us hold the funds accountable and make sure it's well governed and so on and so forth. But some sort of a neutral convener existing outside ASEAN, for example, a global organization, a United Nations agency, or a trusted neutral third party broker country could come in and do the help us with the governance as well.
What's in it for the US to do this? Why do we want somebody like the US to come in and play that role?
I'll take the questions in two separate ways, because if possible, I would not want a third party to come in. I would want ASEAN to do the work by ourselves. But let's take the first question. What's in it for the United States to come in? In recent years, President Barack Obama announced a pivot to Asia. And it's now not called the Asia-Pacific strategy, it's the Indo-Pacific strategy, because the United States is really pivoting to India, China, and the Asia-Pacific as one huge geographical region of the world where the next geopolitical rivalry, and some say even the next world war, is at risk of happening. That's what's in it for the US to come in and rather to assure the security of Southeast Asia, to hold it up as to be supporting them, shall we say. And I think China has the same designs as well. And Southeast Asia in future years will be an area of a geographic area of a sharpening geopolitical rivalry, which is all the more reason for Southeast Asia to unite ourselves. Mm. To your second question, Shawik, as far as possible, Southeast Asia should unite, and we can use health and this pandemic as an opportunity, an external enemy, and the enemy is the virus, and we unite against the virus so that we can preserve our neutrality in the event of any superpower rivalry or even war. And these are important reasons for us to coalesce as in Southeast Asia, and hopefully without the need for any external forces.
Mm. Has something like this, an ASEAN CDC, been floated before?
It has. Okay. The ASEAN CDC is not a new idea. My colleagues and I, if we write the article, we're not the pioneers of this, and we give due credit to the people who have come up with this idea since the 1990s even. There's always been this idea in public health circles and in the academic circles, but this idea since the 1990s never really made it to two groups of people that really make a lot of decisions, the security stakeholders, ministers of defense, ministers of security, and so on. And number two, the ultimate political leaders, for example, prime ministers and presidents of countries. And the ASEAN CDC idea, although it has been around since the 1990s, it's largely kept itself to the academic, health, as well as the public health circles.
Mm. And what's its role within the larger picture of what the World Health Organization does?
It does complementary functions to the World Health Organization. If you recall, I mentioned earlier that three countries in Southeast Asia belong to Southeast Asia Regional Office based in Delhi, and seven countries belong to the Western Pacific Region based in Manila. Because the World Health Organization doesn't have the framework for us to do ASEAN work in a coherent fashion, we have to fashion it ourselves. And that's one interaction with the World Health Organization. I mentioned also the complementarity with the World Health Organization. That's important. It's important because the ASEAN CDC could be an important stakeholder in the global health governance architecture beyond just the World Health Organization. For example, the COVAX facility for the vaccines for COVID, Gavi, or the Global Alliance for Vaccines, or CEPI, or the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, these are additional organizations that an ASEAN voice will be stronger. Stronger in the sense that when Malaysia goes it alone, we're easily pushed aside. We're only 32 million people, and we don't have the soft power of South Korea, for example. Even when Indonesia goes with 250 million people, it doesn't have the geopolitical heft for its voice to be heard. Mm. But when 650 million people and a $3 trillion US dollar economy central to the Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States and the Belt and Road strategies of China wants a seat at the table, we will get a seat at the table.
Mm. You know, all this talk about COVAX right now, and right now, individual countries are joining COVAX. Was there an opportunity for ASEAN to have joined it collectively?
Probably yes, in theoretical fashion, if ASEAN does want to go in. I point to the example of the European Union that joined as the European Union, as individual member states, but it was negotiations were largely led by Brussels. And in fact, it's Team Europe and friends of Team Europe, for example, the non-EU countries like Norway, as a bloc, they entered COVAX. So there was a possibility for ASEAN to come in. However, even before the pandemic, ASEAN was not really cohesive as Europe, which is tries to be a federation, and ASEAN is more intergovernmental. Therefore, we could have missed that particular boat.
I mean, the idea of ASEAN has always been about having that independence, would you call it that?
Yeah. The principles of non-interference national sovereignty often come into the picture. However, a very strong case can be made for information sharing within ASEAN countries. Even if you want a bilateral travel bubble that emerges and coalesces into a regional travel bubble, then we'll definitely need some ASEAN leadership. And finally, capacity sharing as well.
Okay, so let's go for a next break. And when we come back, we'll look at the role that Malaysia plays, whether it's within this regional form of an ASEAN CDC, if it should ever materialize, as well as Malaysia as a global player in terms of global health issues. I'm speaking to Dr. Kor Swee King, public policy specialist. It's the final episode of our mini-series on healthcare in a pandemic. We're looking at health security and cooperation within ASEAN and beyond. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Shao-Ik. In the studio with me, public policy specialist Dr. Kor Swee King. It is our Healthcare in a Pandemic mini-series today, and it's our fourth episode. We are looking at health security and cooperation in ASEAN, what that kind of a multilateral cooperation should look like, especially now that we have the COVID-19 pandemic to really show us, you know, what kind of structures and frameworks we need in place. You know, we've discussed the concept of an ASEAN CDC, which would provide the infrastructure for things like information sharing, stockpiling of emergency medical equipment to be rolled out when a crisis occurs, and that communication that's required. And not currently practiced in a structured manner, even though we are a close, you know, we are close to each other in terms of being the 10 neighboring states in this region. We're close, but not close in a very strange way, aren't we? We're close in terms of travel and trade. But I think the conversation when it comes to health issues hasn't been focused enough. And, you know, the pandemic, I think, regardless of the impact of it, has many lessons that we can draw from. Coming, sort of narrowing down from the regional view, what role can Malaysia play in creating this kind of collaboration that you've talked about? You know, whether it's interministerial conversations and dialogues, or even a very structured setting up of something like a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. What can Malaysia bring to the table?
We can bring a few things. First, we can bring the science. Second, we can bring the manufacturing capacity. And thirdly, we can bring capital. So it's science, manufacturing capacity, and capital. Let's explore these three themes, shall we? In the science, it's not just the public health science, but it's our expertise in public policies, our expertise in health systems and health policies. And in our, it's also our experience in fighting pandemics. After all, Malaysia identified the Nipah virus. We built test kits and probes and primers for COVID earlier than any country in the world. We have the ability to respond to pandemics, and our public health system is tried and tested, and that's something that Malaysia can bring to the Southeast Asia table. Secondly, we can bring manufacturing capacity. We've got local companies that can do various pharmaceutical manufacturing. We manufacture gloves and test kits, and we can manufacture medical devices as well. And the productive capacity of Malaysia and the ingenuity of Malaysia, shall we say, the animal spirits of the private sector, is quite strong in Southeast Asia, and we are one of the larger economies, one of the richer on a per capita basis as well. And then thirdly, I think Malaysia has got very large untapped capital. Most of Malaysia's capital is, well, without going into a lot of conversation about whether or not it's appropriately valued and used, some of this capital can be reallocated or allocated to health. And just from a pure business development perspective, this is one of the growth areas of the world. These are the three things that Malaysia can bring to the table: the science, the manufacturing, and also the capital.
All right. And, you know, looking at the larger global picture, does Malaysia have a role to play in terms of health cooperation at the global stage?
It does.
You know, we always think of Malaysia as a small player, but you know, actually we're handling COVID-19 pretty well.
We are. Mm. We're the 46th most populous nation in the world, but we're 39th richest on a per capita basis rich nation in the world. Therefore, we're punching above our weight if you just use these two metrics. Mm-hmm. And in the COVID responses, on a per capita basis, the number of tests that we've done, the number of is very high. The number of cases is much lower than many other countries. And the number of deaths, number of cases depends on the number of tests that you do. And that can be inaccurate. But the strength of a health system is also more accurately measured by looking at the case fatality rate, the number of deaths due to COVID. And Malaysia does a far better job than many other countries in the world. So can Malaysia play a much bigger role? Yes, we can. Are we playing that bigger role? Are we punching above our weight in terms of health? No, we're not. Two or three structural reasons for that. Firstly, Malaysia is quite happy to remain within our national borders. Singapore has got a larger foreign service and more diplomats than the Malaysian Foreign Service, and I think we should go out a little bit more and be less complacent about being jago kampung, shall we say. And the second reason is that Malaysia feels a bit reluctant to export our talent, as in younger Malaysians and Malaysians in the middle of their career should really consider careers in international organisations and to compete in the external environment, because you are then bringing, you're acting as a mini ambassador for Malaysia, and that these are more structural reasons why Malaysia is not really punching above our weight, shall we say.
Looking long-term beyond this pandemic, you know, what kind of role can Malaysia play at that global stage?
There are a few roles. I mentioned earlier about the science of manufacturing, the capacity and the capital element, so we can deploy them appropriately the first way that we can really deploy them is to help Southeast Asia. Not that Malaysia is the only leader in Southeast Asia. I think there are lots of lessons that we can learn from each other. And by no means am I saying that Malaysia's response is perfect. And I think there are many lessons from other countries that we can learn from as well. So where necessary, appropriate and relevant, we should export our expertise to Southeast Asia. The second example would be a stronger seat at the global table, meaning there are very few Malaysian representatives in international organizations. We have almost no representatives in the COVAX facility or in Gavi and organizations like these. And over a long term, and we're talking 10, 15, 20 years even, Malaysia should put more people there.
You know, you earlier when we were discussing how this ASEAN CDC would look like, you floated the idea of one country being given the authority to sort of take the lead. Could Malaysia play that role?
Yes. Malaysia could play the role, Malaysia as a candidate to play that role, alongside several other countries that have done very well in the COVID era. Mm-hmm. And Malaysia has got the moral authority, to use the term, to play this role because on paper, the number of cases is very low. Our healthcare utilization during COVID is also very low. Although we should spend more on health, for the amount of money that we spend, we achieve pretty good health outcomes as a whole. There are good structural and outcomes reasons why Malaysia could play that role to help other countries respond to COVID or future pandemics or just generally to improve their health system too.
Mm. So we've looked at ASEAN as a mechanism. We've looked at the World Health Organization as a mechanism as well for regional and global health cooperation. Are there any other frameworks that can come into play within the Asia-Pacific region?
There would be two more frameworks that would be important. You've described the international organizations like World Health Organization. Needless to say, there's also the government-to-government relationships. For example, Malaysia bilaterally with in venture Asian country like South Korea and Japan and China and Vietnam and so on. So these are the two traditional routes. There are at least two more routes. The third route, shall we say, is the universities and think tanks and academic routes. And that's where a lot of track 1.5 diplomacy takes place and track 2 diplomacy takes place as well. The more contacts Malaysian universities have with other universities, think tanks with other think tanks, and the academic community, the writers, the intellectuals community have with other writers, thinkers, philosophers, and so on in other communities, the better our health responses would be. This is one. The third one, rather. And a fourth one would be actually the private sector. The private sector is often overlooked. Multinational companies have offices in, multiple nations, capital cities of 90 countries around the world, for example. They have that network. They have the ability to mobilize human resources and capital and also their manufacturing capacity to bring to bear if there's ever going to be a next pandemic as well. These are the four vehicles that Malaysia and other countries can utilize whenever we're preparing for the next pandemic. Firstly, government to government. Secondly, global health organizations. Thirdly, universities and think tanks. And the fourth one, private sector.
And the private sector and the public cooperation that we talk about so much here in Malaysia, that can play out on the regional and global level as well, right?
It can. It requires two things to happen. The first one is private sector companies to form consortiums or consortia. The reason is because most of the time, if you're a pharma company or you're a hospital group or you're a medical device group, you only specialize very narrowly in your field. But the provision of public goods, for example, to create a regional travel bubble in Southeast Asia, requires logistics providers, requires airlines and requires travel providers, requires platforms, for example, Grab, for example, and it requires a consortium of actors to come together that utilize their own strengths. That's one crucial ingredient. The second crucial ingredient is regulation. It's impossible for governments to regulate the private sector at the speed of the private sector because the private sector moves so fast, right? Therefore, some self-regulation in responsibly capitalistic fashion needs to happen so that we let the private sector also find solutions for the provision of public goods. But with enough self-regulation in the first instance before governments sort of follow their lead in order to regulate more effectively across borders.
I like this utopia that you've described, Su King.
Well, hopefully we'll get there.
Do you have a final message to wrap up this topic, as well as the healthcare in a pandemic series that we've been doing?
The word, the Mandarin word for crisis is danger and opportunity at the same time. The portmanteau of the word danger and opportunity. The danger period of COVID will always remain, but it's also past. It's also past because now the world, including all Malaysians or most Malaysians, have an understanding of the disease. We've embedded the education. We understand the standard operating procedures or the SOPs. We understand that this disease is here to stay. So in some ways, the danger is over, and therefore it's time for opportunity. And of that opportunity, it will be an opportunity to redesign health systems in Malaysia, to implement new health policies, to ensure that inequality is reversed as a result of COVID, not sharpened as a result of COVID. Mm-hmm. That requires everyone to play a part. And perhaps we'll end on that note, shall we? A more optimistic note, a more realistic note rather, that there is a lot of work in front of us, but if we take our chances well, COVID can be an opportunity for us to have a better health system for Malaysia.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Dr. Koh Swee King, Public Policy Specialist, and this wraps up our mini-series on healthcare in a pandemic. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us in the last four episodes, Swee King. If you missed any of the episodes in this series, you can download them in our podcast. You can look for Healthcare in a Pandemic on our website, bfm.my, or of course, if you have our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.